From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik. Here's what we got on today's show. As Massachusetts lawmakers ponder whether to give more tax credits to the dwindling number of dairy farmers, those farmers are innovating. One example, a milking robot.
Actually, I shouldn't call it milking robot. It's a voluntary milking system. So the cows go and milk themselves.
Okay, but milking robot just sounds cooler. Then, New England's elms took a beating last century.
When there were still avenues where the whole avenue was lined with elms, they would connect above the street and there would be branches all above you, and it felt like a vaulting ceiling of a cathedral.
That's a rare sight these days, but there's an effort to get the American elm back on its stump. And we wrap up with a look at a Hampshire College project to figure out what slime mold can teach humanity.
Humans have really messed up this planet in a lot of ways. And slime mold have been around for 500 million years and have been very adaptable. And I think it's important that we treat them with intellectual respect.
All that's just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, let's pick up on a story in Pittsfield, Massachusetts we've been following closely. Berkshire Museum lawyers want the state appeals court to quickly decide whether it can auction off parts of its art collection, including two paintings by Norman Rockwell. The court in mid-November issued an injunction halting the sale. One big question now, will the delay affect how much the art gets at auction, if there is one? New England Public Radio's Adam Frenier reports.
The injunction was issued just 3 days before the first batch of the Berkshire Museum collection was scheduled for auction. It's the latest ruling in the legal battle between the museum and auction opponents, including three of Norman Rockwell's sons and the state attorney general's office. The museum wants to use the money to pay for renovations and to boost its endowment. Last month, Elizabeth McGraw, head of the museum's board, initially shrugged off the suggestion that this controversial plan would have a negative impact on a potential sale.
I actually think it may have had an opposite effect. It certainly brought attention to these pieces. I think that's a question that remains to be seen. I'm confident that it's going to be a successful auction as we move forward.
McGraw made that comment, though, before the appeals court halted the auction. Now museum officials and lawyers have told the court a long delay could make it hard for auction house Sotheby's to generate interest from potential buyers, which could be, quote, disastrous for the museum. But the value of the art may have already taken a hit. David Cusin is the founder of a Texas firm that studies art industry economics. He says research suggests that when top dollar art like the two Rockwells doesn't sell the first time it's scheduled, for whatever reason, its value drops somewhere between 30% and 40% for up to 10 years. And that doesn't even take into account the months-long controversy that's surrounded this auction.
If these objects have been besmirched, as it were, it'll add another 10% to 15% impairment in price.
That's somewhere between 40% and 55% all told. Cusin says one thing that might keep potential buyers away, the risk of getting caught up in a lawsuit after the sale.
The fact that it's Rockwell's heirs and family are disgruntled by this adds to the opprobrium. It adds to the weight of liability of anyone who would acquire these pictures.
Sotheby's originally pegged the sale price of the two Rockwell paintings at between $27 and $40 million combined, money the museum was counting on to fund the bulk of what it calls its new vision. For New England Public Radio, I'm Adam Frenier.
Dairy is a key ingredient to your holidays. Ice cream on that slice of Thanksgiving pie, eggnog while setting up a Christmas tree, and I've learned butter is pretty key to stuffing. You probably don't think too much about how those products made it to your fridge, but some lawmakers do. They're pushing to expand Massachusetts tax credits for dairy farmers. Given the state's fiscal situation, it isn't expected to become law anytime soon. But with milk prices down, New England Public Radio's Carrie Healy headed to Hatfield, Massachusetts to check in with Lucinda and Daryl Williams at Luther Belden Farm, which was founded about 350 years ago.
So this farm has been in the Belden family since 1661. Members of the family have been farming the land, and our son Jackson is farming with us, and he is the 13th generation of Belden family to be on this land.
How many cows are you milking now, and what is that system over there?
We are currently milking about 155 cows. In our new barn, it's a 180-stall barn, we have two milking robots. Each milking robot can milk about 60 cows apiece. And actually, I shouldn't call it milking robot. It's a voluntary milking system. So the cows go and milk themselves. And it's been phenomenal. It's our way of being ready for the next generation, investing in the next generation, being able to farm here in Western Mass.
And so where does the milk go?
Our milk right now mostly goes to Guided Dairy down in New Britain, but we are proud Agrimark Cabot members, so our milk can be made into ice cream. It can be made into fluid milk, powder, Cabot butter, a multitude of things.
Milk consumption is down nationally, and milk prices are also down. And Steve Kulik has filed a bill. It's had some momentum in the past couple months. Right now it's sitting in Ways and Means that would kind of bolster that milk price right now. What would that do here?
So that's the dairy tax credit. And we do currently have a dairy tax credit, so it would be to increase that. It does make a difference to us now to have that. The dairy tax credit is when the price of milk that we are paid falls below the cost it takes us to make a gallon of milk. Then that's when the dairy tax credit kicks in.
When on paper you are legitimately losing money, that's when that kicks in.
Absolutely. That is true.
So yep. We're not looking for money when we're doing okay. And that's our goal.
And the other important thing to point out about it is that is designed to help with our expenses. It is not designed for us to buy a new pickup truck, a new tractor. This is helping us pay our feed bill, our electric bill, our town taxes. It's for expenses, not for capital.
A little disclosure here. I was a dairy farmer until the early 1990s, and we don't do it anymore. But when we got out of farming, there were still way over 800 or 900 dairy farms in Massachusetts, and there's nowhere near those numbers nowadays.
No, we're at
150.
Yeah, oh, I heard it was 148, but yeah, it's there. The numbers are small.
I just wanted to add, the dairy tax credit started in 2009, and actually that has helped stem the tide of producers leaving the industry. Now when Lucinda and I go to meetings of our cooperative and other farm organizations, we see young people at the table, and I say that's a great thing for New England to see these young people that are going back to the farm.
This facility we're standing in now is a recent addition to your farm. It looks like you've invested a lot in technological improvements, probably a lot of money in that. How confident are you in the future of dairying in Western Massachusetts?
So that's really hard. It is a difficult thing because, you know, you'd never go into farming for the time off or the money, right? But there are other intrinsic values and other perks to the job. If we didn't believe that there was a future, that people would want a local nutritious product, we certainly would not have made this kind of investment.
That was Lucinda and Daryl Williams at their farm in Hatfield, Massachusetts, speaking with New England Public Radio's Carrie Healy. The 20th century wasn't easy on dairy farmers, but it was even tougher on elm trees. Dutch elm disease killed off millions of the species. Many were old, established pillars of the neighborhood. Towns and forests were notably changed. As New England Public Radio's Jill Kaufman reports, decades later, new invasive pests and disease are killing off other species of trees. Watching this, ecologists have been engineering a comeback for the American elm.
The history of the elm in America goes back to the earliest settlements by Europeans.
This effort to somehow reconcile nature and artifice, the countryside and the city.
Thomas Campanella is author of A History of the Elm called Republic of Shade. He spoke to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Charles Dickens actually talked about this when he visited New Haven New Haven was known as the City of Elms. It had a remarkable collection of elm trees on all its streets. And he wrote that the elms, quote, bring about a kind of compromise between town and country, as if each had met the other halfway and shaken hands upon it.
The elm is a fast-growing tree and can establish itself in a city and a forest. But a century ago, when faced with a fungus known as Dutch elm disease, which usually attacked the tree through a beetle, millions died. But not all.
It's one of the biggest elms left in Massachusetts.
On a neighborhood street in Amherst, Massachusetts, Christian Mark Souza, forest ecologist, stands in front of an enormous American elm. It's an old tree that's about 100 feet tall, settled in a front yard at the edge of the sidewalk.
And it has the classic elm shape where it has all this flare at the bottom from the roots.
The technical term is buttress roots, Mark says. Many old elms that survived over the years, like this one, have been treated with an antifungal. When the tree started to die off and had to be cut down, Mark says a certain beauty was lost.
When there were still avenues where the whole avenue was lined with elms, they would connect above the street and there would be branches all above you, and it felt like a vaulting ceiling of a cathedral.
Marx, who is with the Nature Conservancy, is among the tree ecologists working with the U.S. Forest Service to grow and plant a new population of disease-resistant elms. The goal is to plant them in cities and along riverbanks in floodplain forests. It is a large-scale restoration effort and will take years, but they're on their way.
We're taking them from this size container and putting them in a bigger one and growing them on to 4 to 6 feet.
Glenn Cutting and his family will be tending these elms at their nursery about 20 miles away. Mark's started some of them from branches. The more plush ones, he says, he grew from seed.
And you can see the label here where this is the mother, R18-2. It's highly tolerant selection. And then number 65 is a tree from New England that was really big and lived a long time despite Dutch elm disease being all around it. So we suspect it might be tolerant.
It sounds like it's a lot of engineering. And it is, says Marx. But it's about giving the American elm species a boost. The goal is to get the elm to a point where it can resist pathogens and be a replacement tree for other species in jeopardy, like maples, vulnerable to the Asian longhorn beetle, which infested 35,000 trees in Worcester in 2008. They had to be cut down. Another pest, the emerald ash borer, has killed off millions of ash trees around the country, and it's moving up the Connecticut River Valley. Keith Nislow is with the U.S. Forest Service.
And so our strong focus on entomology and pests and pathogens allows us to do really robust projections about what would be lost.
What is lost when trees are killed off is what Nislow refers to as goods and services that come from nature's complex systems. From the top, shade and cooling. At the lower level, tree roots intercept and filter pollutants that get into groundwater and rivers, like car oil, animal waste, and farm fertilizer.
And so then we have a pretty good idea of what a species that could come in and stand in and provide those services.
Right now, that's the elm. The species, like a few others, has always been a more bang-for-your-buck tree that can thrive in wet forests and tolerate dry city life.
My name is Alexander Sherman, and I am the assistant city forester for the city of Springfield, Mass.
Sherman is standing at the edge of a planting field filled with a variety of species, including about 100 elms grown by the Nature Conservancy's Christian Marks.
These are Christian trees, yep. He brought them down in his car. He had them all packed in, and they're planters, and we had some volunteers out here. And
they're pretty small. It will be another 5 years at least before they're planted in the city, says Sherman. Springfield has been reestablishing disease-resistant elms since 2006. About 400 trees have been planted so far. What began long ago as a New England street tree appears to be taking hold again. For New England Public Radio, I'm Jill Kaufman.
Academics in Amherst, Massachusetts have jumped on an unusual source of scientific and existential investigation, a brainless amoeba known as slime mold. This fall, Hampshire College launched what it calls the first Institute for Non-Human Scholars, and the organizers insist it's more than a gimmick. New England Public Radio's Karen Brown produced this story.
The academic invitation that went out to the single-cell species known as Plasmodium polycephalum, or slime mold, came initially from one man.
My name is Jonathan Keats, and I am an experimental philosopher. I've chosen that as a job title because I don't really entirely know myself what it entails.
Here's what I could figure out. Keats was a somewhat disillusioned philosophy major in college who gravitated towards big conundrums in science, politics, human behavior, things you could actually test, not just ruminate over. Through public thought experiments, he uses absurdity to make a point. For instance, he once opened a restaurant for plants where they could enjoy gourmet sunlight. He attempted to genetically engineer God in a laboratory. He made urban camouflage clothing for turtles and choreographed a ballet for honeybees.
You have to enter into this parallel universe, but it becomes a way in which then to reflect on our own world.
One person who finds this approach intriguing is Amy Halliday. She directs the art gallery at Hampshire College. Last year, Keats came to Halliday with a proposition, one that revolves around that amoeba I mentioned. She remembers Keats saying,
"Wouldn't it be great if we could invite slime mold to be visiting scholars to help us collaboratively solve human problems?"
The visiting slime mold scholars don't get a salary, but they do get their own dank office in the basement of the college's science building. That turns out to be an appropriate place, given that in the wild, slime mold lives on the dark, moist forest floor. If food is scarce, two single-cell slime molds will fuse together and break down the membrane between them. That goes on and on until it becomes what's called a superorganism, a mass of nuclei that all have the same DNA. Megan Dobro is a biologist at Hampshire.
They are at one time many and one, which is, to me, the evocative property about slime mold.
That's also what interested Keats. Remember, he's a philosopher, not a scientist.
That is to say that their mutual interest and their self-interest are one and the same. And we really need to think in those terms ourselves.
Beyond the appealing metaphor, slime mold also offers a great model for experimentation. If you sprinkle oats on a petri dish, the superorganism will seek out the oats, leaving a bright slime that reinforces the most efficient, equitable route from one source of food to the next. The method has been adopted by a field known as biomimicry, when solutions to human problems take their cues from nature. That's why some Japanese trains are shaped like the beak of a kingfisher, or how Velcro was inspired by thistles. Earlier this month, I went to a workshop at Hampshire College, where students and faculty, in true Hampshire tradition, were asking deep questions of the slime mold.
Thinking about why people do violent things, like, and why do they...
So if we can model in the slime mold a presentation of addiction at such a, like, molecular level...
I mean, it does relate to these issues of immigration that we were talking about.
So on one side of the wall, we're going to have, like, a population that has everything it needs.
But at least we can do, like, sugar and oats as, like, the quality of wealth.
This may sound kind of out there, but already scientists have used slime mold to model human infrastructure. For example, they got the collaborating cells to recreate the Tokyo subway system in a petri dish. Megan Dobro studies the spread of HIV, and she's wondering if slime mold can help governments figure out how to get medical care to rural populations. To simulate rough terrain or long distance, they could put salt or light in the petri dishes, things slime mold don't like.
If I took a map of Thailand, can I map the optimal situation for where public health clinics should be placed so that no one person has to travel more than 1 hour to get to a health clinic?
Amy Halliday came up with an experiment that's resonant for someone in my profession, mapping out the spread of fake news.
Since we know that they eat sugar, could we create or use a synthetic sugar, a sweetener, something that masquerades as sugar but isn't the real thing, and see if that could offer us a kind of microcosm for how fake news travels?
Or to model climate change in a petri dish, they can turn up the heat, introduce pollution, or create overcrowding, and see how the slime mold adapt and share resources. Dobro says she did wonder if this approach would be seen as a gimmick.
But humans have really messed up this planet in a lot of ways. And slime mold have been around for 500 million years and have been very adaptable. And I think it's important that we treat them with intellectual respect.
As a science journalist, I love this kind of thing. The symbolism, the potential to teach basic concepts about nature, science, and social policy. But isn't this the kind of kooky project that Fox News commentators would pounce on as an example of scientific conceit gone awry? Yeah, maybe, Keats says, but so what?
It's going to fail in a lot of cases. But I think that humor goes a long way toward genuinely engaging people in the underlying thought experiment.
But what about a college like Hampshire, which prides itself on giving students creative outlets, but is often under scrutiny for its non-traditional approaches, from no grades to removing the American flag from a flagpole last year?
It wasn't easy. We had to sell this project.
Halliday says that meant making a case to the college administration for the rigor of slime mold.
We wanted to make sure that this was also something that followed scientific principles.
They've set the bar a lot higher for slime mold than just withstanding public ridicule. If they get any new insights into, say, border policy or food distribution, they plan to show the results to the World Bank, the United Nations, and maybe the Springfield City Council. And even though it's not likely those institutions will base policy on what the slime mold tells them, Keats insists the message is more than a metaphor.
I recognize the absurdity of saying that slime molds should be put into the White House. I think that we can all agree that that would be a good idea, given what we currently have. But I'm not saying that they should directly be given that sort of power.
And yet, perhaps a little bit of brainlessness can go a long way. For New England Public Radio, I'm Karen Brown.
Karen first performed this story at Live Art Magazine in Northampton, Massachusetts. Original music from John Townsend. This podcast is produced by New England Public Radio, a listener-supported public media company that brings you news and music and NEPR.net. You can find much more news there, and while you're visiting, consider making a contribution to New England Public Radio. Just click that orange donate button at the top of the screen. In fact, right now, it's our winter fun drive, and you can find all sorts of cool thank you gifts. Again, that's at NEPR.net. Thanks so much for listening to NEPR News Now. If you liked what you heard, please give us a rating. Until next time.